Hi everyone, welcome to Building a Better Sefton. This is a special episode with friend of the podcast, Bobby Brennan, former mayor of Sefton, former Labour councillor for the area. Today we're going to be talking about the structure of Sefton Council and how it works, the formal structures, because with a decline in local newspapers, etc., it's not always easy to find out this basic information about how local government works. So Bobby's going to be telling us all about that. He's also going to talk about his latest book and we'll review his previous book about World War II, which I've just finished, which is excellent. Do subscribe, like, share, support financially if you can through the notes. It really makes a difference in getting this news and interview platform out there. If you're watching this not on our Building a Better Sefton YouTube channel, please like and subscribe on there. That just helps us. We're on Substack and Facebook. Get involved and let's get transparency, accountability and fact-based opinion out into the community to build a better Sefton. Bobby, how are you doing today?
I'm fine, too. Thank you.
Cool. And you've just released your fourth book, is that right? Or is it your fifth book? I lose track.
Actually, I just released my sixth book. sixth book comes out on 28th of November. It's called The Spirit of Christmas, and it's a children's book. It's about a mouse called Amelia that it wants to go to Santa's grotto to deliver a Christmas list, and on the way she meets all sorts of different animals, and again it covers the issues around homelessness because she meets a dog that's was bought and then thrown out after Christmas, so because a lot of issues. So, and again it's funny, it's humorous, but I also put in lots of points that not everyone celebrates Christmas, and she meets Santa Claus, and he says, you know, that everyone has their own special events, and we should, you know, support people and be respectful of other people's events. And so again, it's meaningful that there's points in it that, you know, when people read, think, oh yeah, I didn't think of that, and like for example, Santa Claus says to the mouse, next time you're at the supermarket, put an extra tin in the food bank, you know, the trolley. So it's little things like that. So I try to get messages across to me.
So it's like a Christmas carol from the modern era.
Yeah, very good. But I'm also, I'm seven chapters into my seventh book, which won't be coming out till next spring. And that's called Love on the Dole, Phase 2. It's a more take on the Walter Greenwood's, you know, Love on the Dole. But it covers issues around the 1980s, unemployment, the miners' strike, Orgreave. There's a lot of issues like that that's covered in that. So again, it's fictional characters, but I get across the turmoil and the despair and the poverty of that day, the job clubs, everything about it. So I'm hoping that'll be as probably the best one I'll have written.
Yeah. I think you've got a social conscience going through all your books, the one about growing up when you were young, your children's book. The one I just read about, your book about World War II, A Time of Peace and War, which has got some great characterisation. I got quite emotional reading it at times with the characters. And it's like an overview of some of the key events of World War II and how it impacted on a community in Bootle. But also, there's lots there about the details that were going on around Europe at the time with the war. So I really enjoyed that. And I think that social conscience side of things that you bring into your novels, I think it really gives you a, you know, a clear voice of what you want to do. And you're very to the point as well. I find your books just really just flow very naturally. So yeah, I would recommend people check them out.
I think that would, A Time Piece of War, I mean, it's selling quite well. I mean, it's actually sold quite a few in Germany. So I don't know what people in Germany bought will make of the aspect. We're going to cover like the SS and things like that and the massacres in France. It's all part of the characters and their stories. So a lot of it's based on actual events, but, you know, the fictional characters. But a lot of people bought it, and a number of people said to me, oh, why did you do this and why did you write that? And I got upset when this. And characters, as you know, that, you know, were written out of the book, you know, just there was tragedies. In Australia, it's actually described as a book that covers loss and resilience and community spirit. So it's on sale in Strand Books in Broadway. So it's doing quite well across the world. And the message that I've got back from it is people who've read it is, you know, you've got to do a follow-up, but I don't want to do a follow-up to it. So that's why I've skipped from the 1940s to the 1980s, when another period of turmoil and Thatcher and unemployment and mass unemployment and poverty, the miners' strike, what was going on behind that, what, you know, and it covers all that, right? So the real reason why, you know, I mean, for example, people don't realise that the miners were given £15 a week strike pay. That was a nominator, he didn't actually receive it. But that £15 nominated strike pay was deducted from miners' dependents' welfare benefits. They couldn't claim it because they were unemployed, because they were classed as still working or by striking. So the partners could claim welfare benefits for themselves and it pulled them. But then the £15 nominal strike pay was deducted from it. And then that was increased to £16 in about the September. And everything was designed to force them miners back into work. So there's lots of issues like that. And it's how I've covered out. How it impacted on those families and how the suffering that they went through, the miners' support groups. Yes, and the job clubs and the farce of the job clubs and that, like the County Lines book, I've had a lot of good feedback on that because it really sort of puts across what's going on in plain sight. It's hidden in plain sight and the things that you can look out for. So, yeah, I hope that message continues. And so, yes, I've got this seventh book, which is going to be released next spring. After that, probably going to do one around mental health, where, you know, and the experience of service users.
Well, you've got a good creative flow there, and it seems to keep coming. And I think that the County Lines book, I read it in the day, my dad read it in the day as well. It's really riveting characterisation and storytelling, but also it's about that issue of young people being used by gangs to deal drugs and carry drugs around the country. So, again, I really recommend it. We'll do a link to your one of your books so that people can access it through Amazon anyway. But keep up the good work. Now, you've got a lot of experience as a former mayor and as a former councillor, albeit, you know, you left the Labour Party a few years ago and resigned as a councillor over the issue to do with a local park and a lack of community consultation. And you expressed some of your frustrations with the job in our previous podcast as well. In fact, we've done a couple of podcasts with you. But just for the uninitiated and people who kind of know some bits and not all of it, because I find it very hard to follow with the lack of like proper news. So I go on the internet to try and read up about it, but it's quite a pain sometimes finding out exactly how things work at local government. Now, we've got the combined authority that looks at certain issues, which is that kind of wider Merseyside, Liverpool area under Steve Rotherham. But just focusing on Sefton, what's your understanding of how the wards work? Because we've got wards across Sefton. I think it's 22 and there's three councillors for each ward. Do you know how that's decided? Who are the three that ultimately come to represent? Is it based on share of the vote? Do you know any details about that?
When I first got elected to him in 1994, 69 councillors, there was 23 wards. Yeah. And in the year 2000, the Boundaries Commission decided that some of the wards were, as regards to the electorate, they were below what was, you know, the amount for the electorate for each ward. So they decided to change some of the wards round. But also, they put a couple of options to the council. We either, you know, change a few wards to bring the electorate up to the same level, or we scrap a ward. Well, given that it was a hung council at the time, so the Liberals and the Conservatives voted to scrap a ward. It was actually the ward I represented at the time, which was Oddle Ward. So that was being scrapped. But what we did, because Oral Ward at the time covered the old Oral area and also part of Netherton, the Park Lane estate round there, and so we wanted to retain Oral. So we, rather than just have Netherton, we decided to call the new ward Netherton Oral Ward, and I was fortunate to be elected for the new ward in 2000. So there was originally 69 councillors, and then it went down to 66. I think at the time, if it would have been a ward in Southport, I'd have probably voted to have that removed as well. It was purely political. I think Labour would have very much nearly would have been on the verge of taking control the next few years. So it was purely political, and it's politics in a big P. But I'd have done the same if it was a Southport ward. I would have voted to get rid of three Liberal Democrats in McGull or three Conservatives in Southport. So it is what it is. But the wards, so you have the all-out elections. When that ward got changed and the boundary changes, it was all-out elections. So whoever, the three councillors that get the most votes are the ones that selected for the ward. And the councillor that got the highest vote was the one that got the 4 years. Next highest got the 3 years. The next highest got the 2 years. I was fortunate in every election I've stood in quite a number of elections from 1994. upwards, including the boundary change one. I topped the poll in every one of the votes. Former leader of the council, Ian Mayer, said, actually turned around and said, oh, you won't get, to, we'll call you Bobby 4 years anymore because you've got a woman standing against you, Sue Bradshaw. And this was another poll that went after the loss of Dave Martin, leader of the council, passed away. And Dave was probably the best leader that Sefton Council ever had. He was great, Dave. You know, you'd only had to ring the town hall and he'd be on the phone. You know, his door was ever open. But he was a great leader, Dave. So, man, I held in the highest regard. Well, when Dave passed away, they had the by-election, and Sue Bradshaw was standing, as we may have said to me, we can't call you Bobby Foyes anymore because two reasons. It's a woman standing against you, and she's above you in the ballot paper. Well, I actually won the vote. And there was a large, I mean, you had your own personal vote because at the time, Peter Glover was standing Social Alternatives, and people were putting Brennan Glover. And he had Ian Mayer's daughter, Trish Arden. She was saying, why do you put Brennan Glover? Why do you just put two for Labour, this, that, and the other? And obviously, the fact that you recognise sort of that people will see me, I'm doing a good job, and Peter Glover also was as a community activist. So, yeah, so I was fortunate to actually win the All Out, and every time I was elected, I got the highest poll. So I was there for 4 years.
So let me get this right. Whoever finishes in first place has the position for 4 years. Whoever finishes second has it for 3 years. And whoever finishes third gets it for 2 years. And that's how it works, yeah. Okay. And so then some will be unsuccessful and not be elected. And the idea is that if there's a different party there, you can have representatives from different parties as the three. Who were representing an individual board. That's how it works, yeah.
Yeah, and so next year you've got the All Outs next May, so it's going to be interesting. Obviously, there's going to be quite a number of candidates, so it's, you know, any three from, say, 10 candidates. So it's going to be interesting next year, just what happens across the political map sector.
Yeah. So if there's an election in a particular ward, some councillors might not be standing because they're still in position for a bit longer. Is that how it works?
The only time that all the councils in that ward are up for election is when there's an all out.
Right. So when it's an all out, they're all up, yeah.
Yeah. Other than that, it's only one council. But Sefton have done away. I think they've done away with it. Might be wrong about this, but I'm sure that they've gone now to the 4 years because I think Liverpool do every 4 years. I think Sefton's now gone the same way. Where from next May, it's you know those that are elected, it'll be 4 years. Before they're all up again.
In the past,
3 years of elections and a fallow year. I think Sefton have gone for the 4 years, so those that get elected next May will serve the wards for 4 years.
Unless
by-election in between when he stepped down, and of course then there's, you know, do you have the by-election?
Yeah. Well, this is why it's confusing to find out all these details. I think we need just a little bit more, even on like the Sefton Council website, etc. It's good to have your insight into these things. It's something that we'll keep an eye on. So if you are a councillor, a lot of people think councillors are living the life of Riley and you get like a private mansion and a private jet, particularly all over Facebook. You get a lot of criticism of councillors. Sometimes you see people who are basically pro-reform criticising local councillors. And yet when you look at how reform councillors are performing around the country at the moment and even the behaviour of their leader, you know, they're really in the constituency in some cases. You don't know what they're doing in other cases, and they're making a right mess of things in other cases, but we won't go there with that one. So you get basically £11,000 a year for being a councillor, and for many people, that's on top of doing other jobs and having other responsibilities. And the idea is you're a person of the world, and you bring those experiences into the council job. And above that, you then get the cabinet. So how does the cabinet work? You'll have, is it a bit like national government where out of 650 MPs, you'll have a certain number, I forget the exact number now, is it around 50 people in cabinet who are all 60 with senior and junior ministerial responsibilities? So is it a similar thing in Sefton that a certain few will be in the cabinet with key responsibilities?
Yeah, there is, and I think it was Miliband that brought it, introduced it with Labour. I think it's the worst thing that's ever been done, to be honest. I was never ever on the cabinet, so I'm not saying that as sour grapes. I just think it's not very democratic, because you've got 8-9 people who make the decisions, then come back into the Labour group meeting and say, this is what we've decided. You can challenge it. Scrutiny review can challenge cabinet decisions. Well, you can make recommendations. You can't actually challenge them. You can make recommendations and, well, this is the decision. Well, we recommend this. And the cabinet can just turn around and say, well, thanks very much. You know, you've spent a couple of hours debating this. We looked at your recommendations, but we're not going to take any notice to them. So that cabinet is the all powering, overseeing. They make the decisions, and it doesn't matter. Somebody will say, well, we've discussed it in the Labour group, but it doesn't make no difference. You know, the cabinet are the ones that make the decisions. And, you know, in the old days, before the cabinet structure, you had committees made up of all parties. So you're getting a consensus of opinion, and then that committee votes, and what was decided by that committee would be agreed. You felt part of the decision making process as well, you know. And I think, you know, and you hear that from other parties, people with experiences as well. The cabinet, when there was no overall control, the cabinet was made up of members of all parties, so they chair the cabinet post out. You know, that was a lot more democratic than having one party in control where they make all the decisions, because you can't challenge it. There's no scrutiny of it.
One of the things that the government might say is it leads to more effective local governments, and we get this with national governments. You've got a cabinet. Everyone in the cabinet has to follow the party line, and then you have a whipping system. So the MPs who are in that party in the House of Commons, I remember reading an interesting book, and it said 1/3 of MPs are in a cabinet. 1/3 want to be in the cabinet. So then you've only got a real third who are willing to maybe, you know, take a little bit of a risk of upsetting the whips and maybe being deselected or kicked out of the party or whatever. Now, those 8 to 9 people on the cabinet, they have to basically say the same thing, and then they whip the rest of the councillors, because I've heard off the record through people that the local Labour Party, we've got a one-party state locally, basically, haven't we? And there's councils up and down the country like this, not just of the Labour Party. And I think that both me and you are coming from a bit of a leftist tradition, you know what I mean? So we're not looking to just have a go at the Labour Party for no good reason. But, like, there's a perception that the local Labour Party are not very transparent. They make key decisions in cabinet. Everyone else has to go along with it. And if you don't like it, don't make life difficult for you. And I think that is a real, real negative, not just for public perception, but in terms of just the efficiency of local government. Have you got any comments on that?
Well, I don't have a comment on the current Labour leadership, because I'm not involved. I can only go back to when I was around. And take Oddleman Park, for example, which was the catalyst for me to resign. I'd had enough. There was no transparency around that. They were making decisions behind closed doors. They were excluding members of the public, excluding people, purely because they stood against them as independents, former members of the Labour Party. There was no transparency. And then, you know, you're expected sort of to just swallow that and go along with it. Well, when something affects you, your ward, and the people, your neighbours and your friends and in that area, and you're the only one that lives there, well, how can you support something that's, you know, not very transparent? And, I mean, the consultation, that was I refer to that as a sham. But I was reported to the WIP because I copied the pressure group into the emails in the interest of transparency and the Nolan principles, which is, you know, what councillors are supposed to follow, you know, work in the community, be transparent and open and honest. And so I sent emails out in the interest of being transparent, and I reported to the WIP. It got thrown out because the WIP, they said, there was nothing really. There wasn't a case. I hadn't broke party rules, but that's what we're up against, you know, like a cabal, you know, so... But it's Sefton's been like that for years, you know, sort of the cabinet structure. One of the things, again, you know, when Miliband changed, it was supposed to be more democratic. It's supposed to be more democratic. And it should be from the bottom up, not from the top down. Because he introduced the ward, the early committees, and when people used to turn up for them, but then what the excuse was, well, no one's really turned up. It's the same, you know, Joe Public that turns up, this, that and the other, and people would turn up and asking questions and say, oh, well, they're always turn up the same people. Well, so what? They have an interest. Not everybody wants to go to an early committee on a Thursday night or whatever. You know, but those that did attend had genuine reasons for attending, asking questions. But that was scrapped. It was seen as, oh, well, it's not really working, so we'll scrap it. So there's no democracy at local level. You know, and that's what all the change about being more democratic is, with allowing people to be more involved. But that hasn't happened. So the area committees were scrapped. And there's nothing that's been put in place since then. So then you've got likes of, you've got councillors who were, there's decisions being taken in the cabinet, and the public aren't able to sort of, you know, attend these meetings. Public can actually come along to scrutiny of committees, you know, and sit there and I don't think they can go to cabinet, or they are excluded items where even members of the public are asked to leave and things like that, unless when the decisions are made, so that they're sent out the room. No, I don't. It's not. It's not democratic. It's not democratic if you're looking at as a lay person and wanting to know what's going on. And even like the council meetings. I mean, there was. You can't. I think they televised one or two. Well, I think members of the public actually televised them. So, and people should be able to see how the members conduct themselves, because there was a shocking one in Southport. You know. A few months back, and I watched that on the internet. I couldn't believe the carryings on. Not saying that, you know, it's all these councillors that misbehave, and you know, but you get people in the gallery that say things, but people should be aware of what goes on. And so, no, I'm not a fan of the cabinet, and it's not because, you know, these are those are Yahoo sucks, you know, you were in the cabinet, you didn't get on the cabinet, this, that, and the other. Well, I did in the cabinet because I was not within the cabal. The family and friends.
You had responsibilities, didn't you, for things like children's services not long before? So,
yeah, well,
Was that before the cabinet was created?
Cabinet was there when I was on children's services, but that was about 2010, 11, something like that.
Sorry, you can be responsible for something, but not necessarily on the cabinet. Is that what it works?
No. The scrutiny, I was a chair of a scrutiny committee. I was chair of. Right. Audit and governance. I was chair of children's services before all the problems. And I think I'd said in a previous podcast, I set up working groups and had Liberal Democrats chair those working groups, which caused like sort of scratched heads and why are you doing this and this, that, and the other. Well, I was formerly the chair of social services, Labour social spokesperson. And I was moved aside just by the lead at any time. He said, oh, I'm moving you to children's services off adult social care. I says, why? Well, and the excuse, well, I think people should be moved around. That coincided with the adult social care being taken over as a Labour cabinet member's post. So I was moved aside before that. So that was all planned. I knew that. You know, I was moved aside to allow someone else to be put slotted in. And that's the way it is, you know, sort of. But no, the chairs of scrutinies, you chair a scrutiny committee, and then you sort of, that committee makes recommendations. You set up working groups and that, but you don't make decisions. It's not a decision making. The scrutiny view is just to make recommendations, and then, you know, you look at sort of the budget and budget implications, and you will consider the budget, and then you make recommendations about, you know, if, for example, the budget says we're going to make saves by doing X, Y, or Z, then you can say, well, why don't we do this, or why don't we do that instead? Or you can ask, well, why do we have to do this? But the cabinet are the ones that make the decisions. So scrutiny is just basically, I say to scrutinise, it doesn't really do that. Because you can scrutinise or make a recommendation. That recommendation I'm not sure of any time a recommendation has been actually agreed by cabinet. I don't know.
It's a bit like the committees in the House of Commons, the House of Lords, etc. They can give recommendations, but the government can ignore them. So it's a similar situation with the scrutiny committees.
Yeah. I mean, to be fair, though, you do have the opportunity to look at things. So when you had the problems with children's service, now, that's something that scrutiny committee maybe should have picked up on and asked questions at that time. Why was this failing? Because, I mean, I used to ask questions. I mean, we had this issue with older hay services, so we set up a working group, and I had Richard Hands, the Lib Dem spokesperson on children's services. I gave working group to Richard Hands because he was already involved in that when he was the spokesperson the year before. Then Labour took control in 2012. I ended up then being the spokesperson. It was only there for, I think, the 2 years on children's services. But I gave Richard Hands the working group, chair's position. And then I had independent members on the working group as well. So you recognise, and these are the people that know, have got the abilities and know what, you know, what the crux of the matters. So there are opportunities to actually challenge. There were a couple of things I challenged, wasn't happy with. But it is a bit of a toothless tiger because, you know, you're not going to make the final decision. It's the cabinet members that make that final decision. I think now, that scrutiny committee, Bill Simpson's working quite well now. And I'd say there's not a lot of good things about it. And the scrutiny chair, and I think the cabinet member as well is listening I know the last report come out, and I think that's, you know, it's a massive improvement on what it was. But, you know, if Children's Services had got in such a mess, then maybe that committee at that time should have picked up on the issues and been more forceful in their recommendations to Cabinet. I don't know.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. And I mean, whatever structure you get, real life goes on outside council chambers and outside of these rooms where these decisions are made, etc. But I think it is important that people know about these basic structure coming from the wards, the councillors, and the cabinet. I mean, I think that the pay people receive in the cabinet can go up to, I think, 37,000 a year, 26,000 a year total, and that might be a role that someone does full time, which is a little bit different than the councillors who maybe doing other things. Now, the scrutiny committees, as you say, I think that they can embarrass, and, you know, people can go along and find things out. And it can embarrass councils when there's certain things that aren't going well, like Children's Services, and kind of kick things off or get things moving where things need to be moved along. But as you say, it hasn't got any real enforcement powers to change things. Now, what's the relationship like with the officers? Because you have like a permanent bureaucracy, if you like, in Sefton Council. Did you ever have any experience of working with council officers who are like, carries out the decisions of the council mate?
The officers, I think, have a really difficult job, and so, you know, particularly when they're delivering sort of the bad news, and this is how you've got the savings that's got to be made, and as a scrutiny chair, you're given a briefing by the officer, strategic director. You actually meet the strategic director and given a briefing, so you're aware, you're told exactly what the cabinet members are told, so you are given a briefing, so you know what the situation is, but they will look at sort of the agenda, so they'll take you through the agenda for the scrutiny committee, and they'll go through, and you have the opportunity to ask questions of the strategic director. So you are fully, you know, informed. The officers keep you fully informed, and there have been some excellent officers in the Sefton Council, going back to chief executives, going back to Graham Hayward when I first got elected, and then I've had an excellent relationship with council officers and chief execs. They've always been forthcoming information. If I've wanted anything, I've asked for it. And if I've wanted to raise something, then they've made sure that it's been raised as well. And if I've asked for answers, asked for questions, they've always come back with the answers. Mm. So, yeah. So you do with the officers. You do hear over time, people say, oh, this officer, this and that officer, that. But I've never experienced any problems with the officers that I had. You know, I'd work closely with. I have to say, from my time on the council, every officer I worked with was excellent. The clerks, or the committee clerks, were excellent. I cannot fault council officers at all. I think they have a difficult job as it is. But I've never been felt as if I've been sort of stonewalled and, you know, not been given information. If I've asked for something, it's been provided. So I have every respect for council officers. I think they, you know, it's a difficult job being in local government anyway. But I think, I know people have said to me, you know, in the past when I first got elected, you know, he's one of ours and stay with me, he's one of ours, he's one of theirs, this, that, and the other. And he seems to, you know, he's a definitely Labour that officer. But I've had lots of fun. I mean, I don't really know the officers much now. I mean, it's changed the last few years. But when I first got elected, you knew the officers. And it's not, you know, it's not like, you know, on first name terms. It wasn't one of that. It's professional. And I think the officers have always maintained that professionalism. But no, I've had no problems with council officers at all. I hold many of them in high regard.
Yeah, I mean, I've had, when I did trade union work, I worked with council officers, not always in agreement. And my overwhelming impression is that their workload was really, really, I often disagreed with them and would contest things, but the workload to me seemed to be excessive, like through the roof. Obviously, since 2010, austerity lost lots of cuts on the front line, which has put pressure on frontline services. Did you have any experience of the impact of austerity and also the impact of privatisation? Do you have any observations about those two kind of things that started to happen, well, from the 80s right through up until the 2010s?
I think when we were told that the amount we're getting from central government has been cut, and then you've got to sort of manage, you know, a budget with let's say, millions of pounds. You're not going to receive millions of pounds, so you've got to manage with what you've actually got. And you can't run services on a shoestring, you know. And if all of a sudden you're putting, say, for argument, say, 10 million to adult social care, and that's, I'm just using that as a, you know, as a ball figure. And then all of a sudden you haven't got that 10 million, then you've got to then look at, you know, where do we streamline services? Where can we make the least impact without affecting the people that we need to support? So, yeah, I've been through all that, and it's been difficult when you think, you know, this is going to go. I mean, I was around when we closed children's homes, we closed, you know, AMI homes, elderly mentally infirm, and that was just, you know, well, we didn't close them. The Labour were opposed to that, but the other parties actually closed them. And then they've seen a significant savings. And I mean, I know Reform are closing homes and things like that as well at the moment. But, you know, you then close and say youth clubs, for example, or you haven't got money to put in. And then and trying to tell people, actually, you know, we're trying to protect the most vulnerable, which is like the you know, older persons and that. So I've been through all that. It was not a nice time when you look at. And then, of course, the council tax goes up every year as a way of income generating to, you know, to pay for services such as older person services. But you're putting that onto sort of, you know, the taxpayer again. I mean, someone said to me, well, it won't make a difference because most of the, I won't say the councillor who said it, in fact, he's not around now anyway, he said, no, it won't make a difference because most of the people on in down here are getting council tax benefit anyway. Well, you know, that's like, so it's not going to make any difference. We put the council tax up, but it isn't still impact on people. Mm. If you've got a mortgage to pay, and your interest rates have gone up, what you don't need is a hike in council tax as well. So people are going to suffer. And I've spoke to people about this, and he says, well, you know, it's all right for you councillors. You know, my mortgage has gone up. My council tax has now gone up as well. You know, it's all right for you lot. And they think that councillors are extremely well off. My council tax, when I first got elected, was things about 50, well, that community charge and all that. It's trebled what it was. You know, you're paying nearly like £200 a month. And that's a lot for council tax. It's likely to go up again. I mean, it's going to be interesting how they scrap the crime commission. The police and crime commission, there's something like that about that going now. So, and the mayor being making all the decisions. Well, they're already putting money in the council tax goal for them to the Liverpool mayor. You know, you're all hitting people in the pocket. Whoever, it doesn't matter what you're trying to do, then people are always going to suffer as a result of council tax rises. I mean, if someone said to me, would you have your council tax gone up by £20 a year just to keep a children's home open? Of course, yes, I would. You're in a position where financially you're able to do that. You know, that's okay. But when you've got people who are like on low incomes and, you know, universal credit, and they're having to foot those bills, it's very difficult to, you know, to sell that to the public.
Yeah, and it's a very regressive tax, council tax, because the council tax bans are based on stuff that had, you know, was the 80s or whatever. Same with the water. And as you say, the cost of living, the food, everything's going up. People are angry. What I'm noticing locally, though, particularly on some of the Facebook groups, is all this culture war stuff and reform stuff like Doge. And we've seen with, like, reform councils in, like, Kent, I think it's Durham, isn't it? Coming in and going, yeah, we're going to cover all this woke stuff. And you come in and you go, everything's been cut to the bone already. And it's a different kettle of fish. And I know you've expressed concern about the rise of the far right in the past. And when these people come in, you realise that it's not as straightforward as they my character, or if we just get rid of immigrants, everything will be fine. That if we go and get rid of all the woke stuff, everything will be fine. It's nonsense, and it's far more complicated than that. And this perception that, like, oh, the councillors just aren't doing stuff, you get a lot of it with fly tipping. I've spoken to Mike Brennan, who's no relation of yours, from Bootle Action Group. And, you know, he's frustrated sometimes with the local councils. But he often says, like, you know, people do keep fly tipping in certain areas, and it's not always the council's fault. They spend $400,000 a year, I think, dealing with it. And it's about how do you stop that behaviour in the first place. But it doesn't matter who the council are. That's a problem, and there are no easy solutions. And I think that's what people often don't understand about local governments. We can criticise it, and again, transparency, accountability. But once you're in, and the National Labour government have found this as well, although they've shot themselves in the foot too many times to mention, it is tough, isn't it? Particularly with cuts and austerity. And I mean, the social care system for elderly people as well now is just the governments, the national governments have like kicked that can down the road. It's a big, big issue, isn't it?
There are other things such as like some parking outside schools, and there's no parking attendants coming around. Dog fouling, do you think about the dog fouling? I mean, but then, you know, I mean, I put stickers on some of the lampposts by us saying, you know, dog fouling, you know, cleaning up, things like that. But I readily find, you know, dog fouling left outside my gate. People going past them, you just let the dogs foul there and on they go. And, you know, so, but they haven't got, like, so the wardens to go around, and they haven't got people, they can't afford people now to come round and, like, you know, find those that are responsible. So I think there's probably see done, but then there's issues around with the cuts and, you know, traffic wardens and that, because it's made outside here sometimes with the schools, and people just parking, and then that's down to, I mean, I would never park across someone's driveway, but that goes on here all the time, and even though the school, you know, pleads at the parents, please don't, you know, obstruct people's driveways, waste of time, but then that's down to the individual themselves, and you know, and if you can't respect someone's driveway, you can't respect, you know, like pick up dog day, then that says a lot about that individual and that the, you know, the society that they like to probably live in. Council allowances are probably you know, if you get on the cabinet, they are quite lucrative, but for councillors, ordinary councillors who just get the basic council's allowance, you know, they do an awful lot of work for that. I mean, I all the time I was a councillor, apart from one period of about 8 months, I was working. So I had a full-time job and I had to do the council as well. And it just very sort of takes a lot of time. And I think people don't probably understand the amount of work that councillors actually do. And the allowances, it is an allowance. It's to recognise your duties wholly in care and performance. The allowances to recognise the work that you do as a councillor. So the pay that paid to sort of compensate for those going to meetings and things like that. I know there used to be councils that would pay for every meeting that someone went to. Then the allowances, they go to the basic allowance, which just basically covers the whole period that you are a councillor. So if you got, well, I think it was 8,000 when I was elected, it might be about 11 now, so I'm not sure. But that's to cover you for your telephone calls, expense, meet your constituents, travel, and all of that. So it's not really a lot for what people actually do. But then if you're on the cabinet, obviously, then you've got, like, if you're a spokesperson, you get likes of half the council's allowances on top. So you get, say, if it was 8, you get 12. But if you're a cabinet member and the allowance is 12, you get 24,000. So you know. And cabinet meetings, there are not that many cabinet meetings, and sometimes the council. So when you look at the meetings, you think 24,000 for so many meetings, and people in work aren't getting paid that. So I can understand people being cynical of councillors and that, when, you know, if you're struggling on universal credit and you're only getting space to what a councillor's getting, and they're, you know, I can understand people feeling aggrieved by it if the councils aren't doing anything.
That's right, but it's certainly not lucrative, even at the high end of the professional jobs, which are probably on par. Like, for a teacher, for an experienced teacher, they'll be getting paid more in Sefton than the head of Sefton Council per year. And again, it's different funding streams, national and, you know, pay people, etc. But, you know, it's certainly a lot more complex than people think. Just on funding, councils get money from the government, central government. They get money from their own councils and then they generate their own monies. And people like Mike Prendergast have said the government shouldn't be doing, that the local government shouldn't be taking on board all these other things like buying the Strand and all that. They should just be providing those core services. But in my understanding, a lot of councils, there was a terrible case in near London, is it Crawley? Where councils invested in a lot of property to try and make a profit to keep things going, and then the property value has declined and things have failed. So there's all these pressures as well about trying to generate money to maintain the existing level of services. And I think a lot of people don't always appreciate that either, do they?
No. And I listened to Mike Prendergast's podcast, and I was quite impressed with his knowledge. You know, given that, you know, I mean, I think he was on the council just 2 years before I left, and
he's the leader of the Conservative
Party. Yeah, I welcome to the council, which I always think I always do. I always sort of, you know, welcome any new councils to the council, irrespective of what party. For welcome to Seth, and I remember welcoming Mike, introduce myself to him, and just welcome to the council. But I'm quite impressed with his knowledge, particularly around the Strand and things like that. And I have to say, I agree with what he said. I think the Strand is just, you know, is a white elephant. Mm. You know, and I'm all for regeneration. I'm Bootle born and bred. I want to see Bootle regenerated, but I don't think buying the Strand was the answer.
No, but it's a big issue, isn't it? I mean, you have to go out your way to find out what's going on as well. I've been on the internet, onto the Sefton Council website, some WhatsApp groups I'm in, we'll share links. So I've watched like a cabinet meeting, and again, they have bits that are on for the public. And on cabinet, everything's kind of just nodded through, isn't it? Now, I went to a couple of those action committees before they were abolished years ago. Basically, they used to have local ward meetings, didn't they, which I think people could get to easily, more easily. Yeah. Then they made it into this more wider area committee. And as you said, only a few people were going. The one in Southport was well attended, though, and there was often some very good debates between the Liberal and Conservative councillors there. Richard Hands was a great guy. You know, you worked for He was a really nice guy. I did some work with him through a school that I worked at as well. And that was a good one up there. The one down here seemed to be just like nodding things through. And it is hard for people who have got their own lives to find out exactly what is going on. But people are often very ill-informed about what's happening in local governments. And I think the lack of newspapers, the lack of local quality news, it is a big issue, isn't it? And then, obviously, you get people who, as you said quite rightly in your book, people get used to the money in council, and then it's like, they get it, and they want to keep it, and they go, this is good, like, it's good for my family, I'm getting a little bit more income. And it could be going a little bit cosy, can't it? But I think you could say that about any job, really, couldn't.
Someone said to me, when I left the council, someone said to me, you've given up, like, all that money. To me, that was, you know, that was irrelevant. You know, I couldn't stay, quite principled. And there was no way was I, you know, I mean, you cut your cloth accordingly and things like that. You know, I mean, you don't, if you get to be a situation where I'm only staying for that money, then how do you ever then sort of square the road with your principles? You can't, because with me, it led to my resignation. I've had enough after the shenanigans over Oral Mount Park and, you know, what was going on, and I was then being sort of kept out the loop. It was all sorts. I mean, you know, when you put a complaint into the Labour Party nationally to David Evans, the chair, and then it gets sort of shoved under the carpet, you have to ask yourself, you know, what the hell's going on? Well, to me, you know, the council allowances was irrelevant. The people that elected me were what was most important, and I thought, there's no way I'm towing the line and staying just because I could lose sort of, you know, 12,000 or 16,000, whatever it was at the time. That was irrelevant. It never once entered my head, I'm going to be down by this amount of money, because I joined, got involved in politics to better the people that I represent and in their interest. Not in their interest to sort of for me to stay just because we're getting sort of paid, you know. So now, but someone actually said that to me, and I thought, yeah, no, I'm not there for that reason. But yeah, I know. Yeah. Someone actually also said to me that you get used to the money. Well, you know, yeah, I did, but it wasn't the be all end all. I mean, there comes a time when you decide, what comes first, the interest of your constituents and your principles, or and keeping this money now.
Yeah.
But yeah, it must be difficult for some people to let it go, but
It is. I think if most people, though, if someone said to you, oh, you're going to lose your job in 2 years' time or a year's time, or you might, it's not nice. And it does cause crisis in people's lives. And I get that. People don't want to lose income and stuff. I think some of the stuff which is often thrown at councillors is very unfair. And honestly, I don't think the Labour group, particularly in South Sefton, has helped themselves with the family links and the lack of transparency. And I've been in meetings with you. There are other people in the local Labour Party I've been in meetings with. I thought, you know what, I might not always agree with that person, but they're essentially a good person, like yourself in Oral and Netherton ward meetings when you were chairing. And I've been in other meetings where there's real Machiavellian types who obviously don't want anyone turning up who they don't know. And it doesn't look good, and it doesn't really convey a positive message. And I think it's like in politics. You look at in the States now, you've effectively got a president who's generated $3 billion for him and his family in plain sight. You know, Farage is on at least $43,000 a month, allegedly, as a minimum for non-parliamentary work. And this idea that, we just need to pay them the right amount of money and then they won't want to have pursued their interests, or, oh, they get enough money, they should live on the average wage and all that stuff. We're going to be debating this for time immemorial, what the ideal system is. But for me, this idea that you're like all politicians are the same and that, oh, they're all in it for the money, it's a lot more complex than that. And it's very unfair, I think, to just say that without qualifying it and showing nuance.
Yeah, I mean, you could have a situation where councillors didn't receive allowances, because that would be grossly unfair, because you can't do the councillor's job. You need some remuneration. It's down to the individual. If they're there because they're dependent on the money, that's going to cloud their judgments and how they behave in the future. Because if you're going to say something, that's going to mean I could be off the cabinet if I go against this. You then sort of put people in a situation where it's the money. And I don't think it's the prestige of the cabinet. I think it's the money. And if I say anything or I do anything, I'm going to lose that. Well, it shouldn't be in politics for that matter. You know, your hands are tied and then you're being shackled by the pound signs. Yeah, and you shouldn't be staying there because the pound signs. I mean, I've heard lots of comments, on the council about, council's allowance, I've heard about people's... But that's just... When that said to me, you're walking away, you're losing this, and how can you just walk off and lose your allowances and lose this and your spokesperson? But I was on the board of the chair. I was the chair of the board of New Directions. I was actually put on that. I was there when New Directions was formed, which was a long time ago. I was on that for 15 years, but it was when it was formed as the council's sort of standalone adult social care provider. I was the Labour spokesperson for social services, so I was put on the New Directions board because I was the Labour spokesperson, and it was the only board that didn't receive an allowance, and that went on for I think I'd been on it for 13 years before the union said, and a former cabinet member who said to me, "You don't get an allowance for this." And I said, "No, I don't. It's just and it was you're looking at two meetings a month as well." And I said, no. The interesting thing, when I was removed from children's services, so to adult social care as a spokesperson, I was kept on New Directions, which is strange. You take me off adult social care, put me on children's services, that freed up the adult social care cabinet post, but they kept me on New Directions, which is, you got to ask, well, why did they do that? So I was on that for 13 years, and it was the trade unions and a cabinet member that used to be on, a former cabinet member who was on New Directions as well, who, when we took control, we had more Labour members. And I become the chair of it then. And I then give the trade union to spot on the management board. Said, want the trade union involved. So they had been on the board. And it was then that raised the issue that you've never been given allowance. So then they decided to give me allowance, which was the equivalent of the council scrutiny committee. So they've looked at a pay scale. They've been paying the directors 8,000. He said to me, as the chair, we want to pay you £10,000. you know, as the as a chair. And I said, no, it stays as the same as a council scrutiny. And I agreed. I said that. I said the union, the staff have never had a pay rise, so I'm not giving a pay rise as the chair. When the staff get a pay rise, then I look at it again. But I just said it stays. So I declined to accept that 10,000. It stayed as the equivalent of a scrutiny committee. And I had people saying to me, "You're bonkers. You're off your head. You know, you've turned all that money down." But again, there was a principle involved. Mm-hmm. How could you justify getting a whopping salary allow when staff have not been paid? Mm-hmm. And I was told by the unions that they saw me as a protector of their terms and conditions. And what I did by doing that was shown true leadership and saying, you know, and that was put back to me, you've shown, you know, that you've shown true leadership by not accepting that allowance. The others accepted it. The other cabinet members accepted it. I've never got on the cabinet because, you know, irrespective of me having ability and I know how you know, family and friends are put on. It's always been the way, you know. And I'm glad I've not been in that swamp, to be honest. You know, I walked away from politics and I walked away and you know, with never having been in that situation where, you know, I could be accused of the money is all that was important. And people said to me, you know, about giving up new directions and this, that and the other. And, you know, and that tells me a lot, that it's just money for people. It's just about the money. And that's when that leaves a sour taste in my mouth, that it does.
And I think that's a good point to finish that, about the importance of principles in politics, about being paid fairly for what you do, but also remembering what we're supposed to be doing it for. And it's just that eternal question.
Yeah, I'm not saying that the those on the cabinet are not principles. I mean, because I've worked with, you know, with most of them over the years. But I think, to me, I don't agree with the cabinet's position. I don't think it's democratic. We've done away with the ward committees, we've done away with the area committees, so there's no democracy at local level. So there's no opportunity for the public to get involved. And that's the demise of democracy. And so Labour's plans, Miliband's plans, are to bring democracy back to the people. It hasn't worked. And of course, now we're going to see the results of all that inability to work with the communities. We're going to see the results of that next year, reform, when they likely sort of gain seats across the country.
I think one of the issues as well with the rise of reform, it's not necessarily people who are just anti-immigrants, you know, far-right people, you know, people who are quite openly racist. Or you might not describe themselves as racist, but there'll be a lot of anti-politics and a lot of, like, giving someone else a chance and someone different a chance as well. And I think that's why it's important to, like, really look at what these people want to do before people vote.
At the moment, they've got the narrative, and they people are listening to the narrative, you know, the flags and all that. So, you know, people are listening to reform. And the thing is, if they do get councils in Seth, well, you have got one council in Seth, and if you do get any more of your councils around here, they're not a prescribed organisation. You have to work with them, and that's going to be, you know, they are elected members, but then they have to serve all the community. And we've already seen that the mistakes they're making in those councils that they actually control, and some of the policies they're putting forward. Some of the policies that they're putting forward, if they get into power, are worse than what Labour plans, like welfare cuts. So people need to be aware of, you know, but you get what you vote for. The most vulnerable in our society are going to be feeling the impact of reform getting into power, if they do get into office nationally. You know, Labour of now trying to sort of outdo reform.
Yeah. I mean, that national debate on where Labour needs to go, we won't cover that here, but they seem to be trying to move closer to reform to offset people moving to reform. But I don't know. I don't think it seems to be working. I don't think the data backs that up either. And, you know, we'll see what happens next May with these local elections.
Yeah.
Right, Bobby, listen, thank you very much for your overview of how Sefton Council works, also your own experiences and insights, and also about your book. So best of luck with your books. Thanks for your time here today. But I'd just like to thank you for coming on again and sharing your wisdom, knowledge and experience. So, Bobby, thank you very much. Thank you.